You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko shimena toku ingoa, no mai, haere mai, ki te wai, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire. Today is Wednesday the 31st of May. I'm Shimena, your Wednesday host, and as usual, I'm joined by my producer, Adam. We're also joined by, turn your mic on.
Here we go.
Now you can speak to the people. sorry about that. Also, got another producer helping us out today, Will, who's done a piece for us. But what we have on the show for you, we speak with Retail New Zealand and First Union regarding changing Auckland's Easter trading laws. New Zealand First's Tracy Martin joins us discussing the budget announced last week. AUT's Alan Blackman is back from holiday, slash work, for Dear Science, again, our regular Wednesday feature. And we speak to politics professor Grant Duncan on anti-establishment sentiment. And finally, we speak with Thomas Owen about his expeditions and research in the Yukon in Canada. So as always, let us know your thoughts about the stuff that we're covering today. 5395 is the number to text, or 309 3879 if you want to call us up and have a chat.
You're tuned into The Wire.
Yes, so first up on The Wire today, the Auckland Council are wanting to know the public opinion regarding changing the rules surrounding shop trading on Easter weekend. The proposed bylaw will give communities around Auckland the ability to choose whether or not to open on Easter Sunday. But this decision is drawing both praise and criticism from within the business community. Firstly, I spoke with Retail New Zealand spokesperson Greg Harford regarding the changes and asking if they are a necessary thing.
The current rules are really, really complicated. The idea is that most shops are expected to close, but there's a whole host of exemptions in there. They just really don't make sense in the 21st century. We've got convenience stores are allowed to open, but supermarkets are not. Garden centres are allowed to open, but hardware shops with a significant garden centre inside them are not allowed to open. The reality is that some customers, but not everyone, want to be able to go to the shops on Easter Sunday, and some businesses, but again, not all, want to be able to open. So we really don't think there's any compelling case to keep the restrictions in place, and we're fully supportive of proposals to allow businesses the choice as to whether they open on Easter Sunday next year.
Do you feel that due to this confusion, it creates an unfair advantage for certain businesses?
The current rules where shops are required to be closed certainly create disadvantages for some firms and advantages for others. A classic case, as I say, is garden centres. Garden centres are allowed to be open on Easter Sunday, but hardware shops who sell much the same thing are not. So it just doesn't really make sense to have a rule that doesn't apply equally across the board, especially when there's actually increasing consumer demand to be able to shop. Customers shop 24/7 online these days from home. Many also want to be able to hit the shops on Easter Sunday. But obviously, if the council goes ahead and adopts a local shop trading hours policy, there's no obligation on any business to open and no obligation on any customer to shop.
Do you feel that there's a need then for a single Auckland-wide rule set?
Yes, we'd strongly favour a single Auckland-wide rule set. We've got, I think, around 25 councils around the country now have adopted shop trading hours policies that allow businesses, shops in their districts to open on Easter Sunday. They've all gone down the track of a district-wide approach. We think that makes the most sense. It's less confusing for businesses and customers and employees, and in fact it helps avoid some of those competitive issues that we talked about earlier.
So it would allow for a myriad of advantages essentially across the board if widespread Easter trading were to be allowed?
It's about choice at the end of the day. We think in the 21st century that government and local government really don't have a place regulating shopping between consenting adults. If businesses want to open and that suits the demands of their customers and their employees, then we think they should be able to do so. It is important, I think, to remember that under the law as it stands, there are special protections put in place for workers around Easter Sunday, so nobody is forced to work if they don't want to do so. And indeed, no business can be forced to open. It just becomes a matter of choice.
There have been concerns surrounding the forcing of employees to work. You don't think this would be the case?
No, we certainly haven't heard about that happening this year in any of the districts which have now allowed their shops to open. And as I say, there are specific rules built into the legislation that make it a specific offence to require anyone to work or to disadvantage them in any way if they don't. So we think there are really good protections built in there for workers and also for small businesses who may want to take the day off.
For the counter-opinion, I also talked to First Union Retail and Finance Secretary Maxine Gay, reiterating with her if changes needed to be made.
Certainly not. Our union has already written to the council before it made that decision, urging it to adopt a policy of retaining the status quo. There are only 3.5 days a year in which the shops are required to be closed. So that means there are only 3.5 days a year in which retail workers are guaranteed to have days off.
Right.
So we think it's completely unnecessary, and it's not even being driven by a large number of retail employers indicating that they want this. In fact, I would say that the overwhelming majority don't. It's simply being driven by one or two.
So do you feel like this is more of a business-oriented decision rather than something that's coming from a people perspective?
Absolutely it is. There's no... People often argue that because New Zealand is a much more multicultural country than it was when these regulations were first established, that there is no longer this big push from people of a Christian faith in order to be able to not have to work on those days. Whereas, in fact, Easter itself and Easter Sunday has morphed into a much greater thing where whole families get together, marae get together, large sporting organisations run all sorts of activities over those long weekends purely because they are guaranteed that additional day on the Sunday. But as well as that, there are still a significant number of people who do have a strong Christian faith and for whom, for them, Easter Sunday is a day of huge significance.
Right. One of the main concerns surrounding the current rules is how confusing it is. Certain places are allowed to open while certain places are not allowed to open. Do you feel like this should be addressed somehow, even if it means the blanket closure of all retail stores?
One of the things that we have consistently argued is that you need to have some changes to the regulations. The regulations are archaic, but in order to get some good sense, you don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So you don't need to liberalise Easter trading in order to fix the anomalies. But the government has chosen not to do that. And instead, it's gone for this piecemeal option where local authorities right throughout the country get to make the decision themselves. How nonsensical is that? You know, instead of one national conversation, you've now got multiple conversations going on. And if you're a national chain, for example, and you've got stores in a whole lot of places, you know, some will be open, some will be closed, depending on what the various local authorities are deciding to do. So I think this is probably about the worst of all worlds, and even, in fact, those that were proposing or wanting further liberalisation, they don't like this either.
Right. Have you heard of any concerns from retail workers themselves regarding this proposal?
Oh, yes. I mean, our members are engaging in the submission process. They are writing submissions. They are collecting signatures on petition, and the union itself will be submitting to the Auckland Council as well as having written to them. Even shop managers are signing the petition. So, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, both in shops and in banks, because remember, a lot of banks in Auckland are open 7 days. They're located in malls. And if the mall decides to open because the local authority says it can, then those establishments will be forced to open even if they don't want to. So there's a lot of activity going on, and people are looking to engage in the submission process to urge the council to retain the status quo.
Right. So it has been a majority concern then, not a minority.
Oh, totally. And that includes, for example, managers of supermarkets who are allowing our union organisers to collect signatures during the working day because they themselves are signing the petition as well. They don't want it open.
Right.
So, and it's really interesting. If you look at the farmers' department store in Rotorua, Rotorua is one of those local authorities that has voted to liberalise. In fact, a lot of it was, you know, driven by Stevie Chadwick, the mayor of Rotorua. But a whole number of shops, like Farmers, actually chose not to open, even though they could. And so, you know, there isn't a widespread appetite, even amongst employers in Auckland, for this to happen. It has been mostly driven by foodstuffs, which is just, you know, largely non-unionised. So workers in that group of companies, you know, the Pack and Saves and the New Worlds, they won't even get any extra pay or a day in lieu if they're forced to work.
Right. Under the provision, there is the right for the employees to refuse to work. Do you think that employers would still put pressure upon the employees to come in, regardless of the case?
Of course they will, because, you know, pressure occurs in all sorts of ways. A lot of people won't know the exact nature of their right. In Blenheim, for example, where liberalisation occurred, we also, you know, the employers announced their intentions outside of the allowable time. And yet this is at a time when awareness should be at its highest. So an employer has to tell workers within 4 weeks of its intention to open and then give them a further 2 weeks in order to decide whether or not they want to work or not. And they're not even meeting, even when it's at its, you know, higher stage of awareness, they're not even meeting their obligations and they're making these announcements just a week or so out. So as time went on, that will erode further and further and further.
Right.
But pressure takes place in all sorts of covert ways as well as overt ways. You won't have an employer standing over a worker saying you have to work, or you might in a non-unionised place, but in most union agreement, where there's union agreements, that probably won't happen. But if you're not a team player, if you don't, you know, come in for your normal shift on a Sunday as a supervisor, you know, you'll be passed over for promotion. Everyone knows how the game works. And so people are way too frightened in order to say no if they know their employer wants them to work.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
The genre-bending Borderline Music Festival returns to the Wine Cellar and Whammy this Queen's Birthday weekend, offering up an excellent weekend of underground artists from here and abroad. Cricket Farm, Tim Guy, Waterfalls, Bozo and Harvey Unclear, PHF, Lapis, Bad Sad, Long Distance Runner, Astro Children and Mermaidens, Human Resource, The Convoy, Eyes No Eyes, Teeth, Pleasure Magenta and so, so many more. Borderline Music Festival at the Wine Cellar and Whammy, June 2nd, 3rd and 4th. Single night and weekend tickets from Flying Out and Under the Radar.
Always an enigmatic presence floating on the fringes of the mainstream, Evan Dando returns to our shores for an intimate solo show at the Tuning Fork.
Honey, it looks like you.
Celebrating the reissue of his 2003 solo debut, Baby I'm Bored.
This is the
known and revered both as a solo artist and as a frontman for the Lemonheads, Dando brings his extensive back catalogue, magnetic stage presence and all-star grab bag of surprising covers for a rare Antipodean visit. Don't miss out. Evan Dando, live at the Tuning Fork, Sunday, June 4th. Listen to 95BFM for your chance to win tickets.
Wake up, Auckland. Breakfast continues to be louder.
Hello, good morning, everyone. Good morning. Mikey Havoc here with you till 10 o'clock this morning, broadcasting from Auckland, New Zealand, Tamaki Makaurau, on top of the volcanic plateau.
Mikey Havoc. Breakfast.
The ocean today, how does it undulate?
We've got a building wind swell at the moment.
Roger that. Thank you very much, Michael.
No worries. You want to hear about the West Coast, Mikey? Or
you just played me then, eh, Mike? You played me then.
Breakfast.
Would you like to talk the hurdy-gurdy with us this morning?
You know what? There's no hurdy-gurdy in that song.
Weekday mornings.
Here's today's Tracachino. It's a Jane's Addiction song because they're the greatest band in the world, but it's not the most obvious one on the record, but it is called obvious.
Mikey Havoc Breakfast. Woo! Weekday mornings, 7 till 10 on 95 BFM. Thanks to Burger Fuel.
Good on ya.
Now it's time for Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
Yes, it is indeed. We'll be with Tracy every Wednesday on The Wire from now on. How are you doing, Tracy?
Not too bad. Thank you very much.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm excited to talk to you about politics every week.
Yeah, thanks for asking me.
So today, what I wanted to chat to you about is New Zealand First's take on the government's budget announced last week. So talk to me about your perspective. Good, bad, somewhere in between?
Okay, if I was going to put it into sort of a colloquialism from my age demographic, it would be that it's a better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick, is probably how we would put it.
Okay.
So people will know that last week we voted on a taxation bill which shifted the tax thresholds a little bit. But probably most importantly for New Zealand First, and I think you'll find for the Green Party, was that there were some incremental increases to the accommodation supplement.
Mm.
And that we voted for that piece of legislation because we know that things are so desperate out there for so many people around housing costs and accommodation costs, that to not vote for it would have just been just too mean. It just wouldn't have recognised what's really happening out there on the street. But apart from that, I mean, the budget debate's underway now, and we will oppose this budget. I mean, it does nothing for so many areas that are under stress.
And so what, talk to me about those areas. What do you think are the biggest ones?
Well, if we have a look, let's just take a couple of areas that are mine, you know, that I I work in. First of all, let's just have a look at education and have a look at special needs. Support for children with high physical, emotional and sort of neurological needs. Now, what this government has done is it's announced a certain amount of money spread over 4 years that will increase the amount of support for 4,000 children in New Zealand by 1 hour a day. So 5 hours a week.
Hmm.
And if I can just give you an example of the actual need, and let's take a child that nobody could say it's got anything to do with his home environment or anything else. Nobody could criticise anything about this little boy's illness in any way, shape or form. So he has type 1 diabetes and he's 5 years old. Now he goes to school because he has the right to go to school with his friends for 30 hours a week. That includes playtimes and lunchtime. Now he's funded for a teacher aide and he has to have a teacher aide with him all the time because he needs to have his blood sugars monitored, right? He has a teacher aide that the state will pay for 21 hours. So what happens in the other 9 hours? That's the point. That's the point of what's happening in the budget, is, you know, the government has dropped a bit of money into a bucket over here saying we've given some money for all those children that need this support. But the reality is it doesn't go anywhere near to being a practical solution to what is the actual problem.
Yeah, because I mean, I guess the budget has been described by a number of commentators as quite an interesting shift to the left by the national government, that this budget actually does have a lot to offer for lower income families. I mean, when you were mentioning the accommodation supplement, some families could have as much as $145 plus a week due to these accommodation supplement increases. But you're saying that this is not enough and that the increases have just not gone far enough?
Well, I think the criticism of that accommodation supplement is absolutely valid, the fact that it just passes straight through the hands of those New Zealanders into the people who own their flats. Now, and I'm not going to have a go at people who are landlords. We need people who are landlords because right now so many of our citizens can't afford to buy a house. So it's either have landlords or actually have more people in cars. But let's get real. It's not a solution. It's not a solution to the problem, which is the, you know, the incredible lack of accommodation, the incredible lack of housing, the fact that most of our families or many of our families don't have enough income from their working week to pay their rent.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a supplement because we've got a massive issue right now and we needed to pass it. But long term, where's the plan long term? Where is the big vision long term? That's the question, and this budget does not show any vision like that.
And so I'd like to talk specifically about the health sector. So total health spending will be a record $16.77 billion in 2017-2018, which is an increase of $879 million, with an overall increase of $3.9 billion over the next 4 years. Is this not enough?
Well, I think what you've got to do is, and this is what the opposition's been trying to actually point out and get the government to answer, what is the actual person, you know, spend? What is the actual person spend compared to what it was in 2008, 2009, to what it is now, considering the increases in population? Because, you know, we hear the same argument from this government around we're spending more money than ever before in education. Well, I'll tell you what, we've got more children than ever before. We've got more children in ECE, but we've just got more children. We're spending more money in health than ever before. Well, we've got more people, 72,000 net just in the last financial year. So do you see what I'm saying?
The numbers, but I mean, you have to give credit to the government, though, when they have actually increased the number of doctors and nurses working in DHBs across the country by more than almost 7,000 since 2008, which is an increase of over 28%, which fares pretty well considering population growth, which is about 8%. So that you have to give them credit in that respect. Can't you?
Then why were the junior doctors going out on strike last year because they had such long working hours? And why are the rural doctors actually screaming out because we don't have enough people out in the region? So it may be that they've increased it by 28%, but why is there still such high need then? It's one thing to say what you've done over here. The other thing is to say, but is it actually an answer to the problem?
And so I would also I'd also like to know your thoughts about mental health as well. Do you think that they are increasing a lot of funding, but do you think funding is the answer, or are there more answers to the mental health issue that we have in New Zealand?
Well, again, it comes back down to where your funding's going. I mean, when I first came into Parliament, so this is my second term, John Key had announced a $62 million fund for youth mental health, and that was to address the causes of youth suicide. Now, I'm fairly confident by saying that youth suicide has not dropped in the last 9 years, okay? Now, I'm not blaming the national government for the youth suicide rates, but what I'm saying is I then put in questions to the minister about where is the spend of that $62 million? And the answers I got back in the last term were that they had developed one website. So it's not necessarily the amount of money, and the government's the first to say it. Where is it being spent? And I'll give you an example. This government, the Ministry of Education, has refused for a number of years to actually change the counsellor-student ratio inside secondary schools. Now, we know we've got a crisis of anxiety inside our secondary schools, not to mention our tertiary. So why won't the ministry, why won't the government, change down those student-counsellor ratios so that we can actually have more, you know, more counsellors on the ground working at the front end of the problem rather than waiting for our young people to actually need major mental health services?
Would you support an inquiry into the mental health system in New Zealand?
I would.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's mounting pressure from a lot of groups in New Zealand for that to happen, but the government doesn't seem to be too keen on doing that anytime soon.
I think Mike King coming out recently and actually saying, listen, and I can appreciate his frustration, but I can also appreciate, you know, the ministry people he was working with. When you're told by the government the envelope is the envelope and we don't care what the solutions are, you must stay inside the envelope, it's an incredibly frustrating place to be.
And just really quickly before we finish, Winston Peters has said recently that Kai Koura was ignored in the budget. What more do you think the budget could have offered to this region?
Well, the businesses need more support and for longer. The small and medium-sized businesses. I think what we're finding is that some of the larger ones have got some salary support, but the small SMEs, they really need some support.
Right, so more support for their recovery.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much for speaking with us, Tracy. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, Shamina.
All right. Take care.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party.
The Wire. Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, now I'm joined by Alan Blackman, AUT chemistry professor. Sorry, Alan, just like straight from one life thing to another. We're just getting straight into it because we've got a very packed show today.
It's all happening.
So the first story that we're talking about today is about a new shared science centre called Open Sesame, which is set to open in the Middle East. This is a very exciting project.
It is a really, really cool project, actually. I was really pleased to see this in the news. What this sesame thing is a synchrotron, and possibly your listeners, might not be familiar with what a synchrotron is. Mm. So by way of introducing this, imagine if you put a 15-watt light bulb in your front room and turned it on, you would sort of see everything in your room, but it wouldn't be particularly distinct or anything like that. And then you go and put a 100-watt light bulb in, and then you can see everything much more clearly. Everything's a lot more distinctive. You can see the fine detail, et cetera, et cetera. And this is what essentially a synchrotron does. So its purpose is to generate light, in inverted commas. And by light, we mean radiation ranging from the infrared and the visible and the ultraviolet and X-rays. And in chemistry and physics in particular, we use light to study the structure of materials. So we can get the structure of molecules down to dimensions of 10 to the minus 12 meters, you know, absolutely tiny. So we're talking molecular scale here. And in order to do that, we need very bright light, okay? Be it infrared or visible or ultraviolet or X-rays. Mm. And synchrotrons are the best way of generating this really, really, really bright light that we can use to study everything. And they don't come cheap, so they cost around about a couple of hundred million. That's in Aussie dollars, that's what the one in Australia costs. So there's about 60-odd synchrotrons around the world. Closest one to us is in Australia. And so last week, this new synchrotron in Jordan was opened, and that might be no great shakes to everyone listening, but the important thing is that this is a collaborative project between countries such as Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Jordan, Iran, Cyprus, Turkey. Okay, so
a lot of places that haven't historically had the happiest sort of political dialogue.
Indeed, yes, yes. So politics seem to go out the window in this case, and
that's really awesome.
I think it's absolutely fantastic. So we're going to get scientists from Iran and Israel collaborating. We're going to get scientists from Cyprus and Turkey collaborating, and this is absolutely wonderful. And this will be a real asset to the scientists in that part of the world. It's the first synchrotron to open in the Middle East, and it's going to do remarkable things. So, you know, that's a feel-good story, I guess.
Yeah. It's always good to have those on the wire. We often don't, so, you know.
Well, we've got Médecins Sans Frontières. You could perhaps call these Scientifiques Sans Frontières, perhaps, but if we wanted to be a little bit, yes. So I think that is a really, really wonderful story, and it'll be interesting to see how that transpires. But as I said, it was opened last week. Funding for it comes from those particular countries, plus they're also getting helpful funding from the EU, I believe, as well. So they're also putting money into it because, as I said, it's not a cheap thing. And the upkeep also to keep it running is substantial. So we're millions of dollars a year sort of thing.
Mm. So from what I understand, this idea of a Middle Eastern synchrotron has been on the table for decades now, but now it's actually come into fruition.
Yes.
So what's shifted?
That's a really good question, because a few years ago Israel supposedly assassinated a couple of Iranian scientists who were part of this project. So, you know, something massive must have happened since then.
I know. Cooperatively.
But, you know, they're obviously letting bygones be bygones in the name of science, which I think is absolutely fantastic. And if the rest of the world could follow suit, then, you know.
Absolutely. Mm. And so what are the impacts of this for the future of scientific research in the Middle East?
It can't help but help. That's basically it. This is state-of-the-art machinery. And generally you only find state-of-the-art machinery in sort of, dare I say it, your first world countries, you know, your Europes and your Americas and et cetera, et cetera. And I think to see this in this part of the world is just you know, really, really wonderful. There are a lot of fantastic scientists in that part of the world, and whose science is limited by basically the equipment that they have got. Mm. Now they've got access to this, you know, the world is their oyster.
And maybe they would have had to potentially go overseas further their career, whereas now is more opportunity for them to stay in the Middle East, so kind of combating that brain drain.
Yes, yep, absolutely. And when you are using these machines, like a lot of New Zealanders use the Australian machine, you can book time on it for, to, you know, sort of about a year in advance, and they might give you a day or something, and you're up 24/7 on that day. You don't sleep, you don't eat, you don't do anything, you just do your stuff. So, you know, time on these things is very, very highly prized. So I think it's great.
Cool.
Really nice.
And so our next story today that we're looking at is a New Zealand-related one. So New Zealand's Alpine Fault has been found by researchers to have extremely hot temperatures and high fluid pressures. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean? Talk me through.
Well, I think the geologists are still trying to figure out exactly what it means, which is, I guess, part of the thing. But last week there was a paper in Nature published about this, which is, you know, which is fantastic. Whenever New Zealand gets a paper in Nature, I think that's a wonderful thing. So this is a joint project, I think about 100 scientists from 12 countries, and what they did was to go to the Alpine Fault and drill two holes into there, and they got roughly around about a kilometer deep into the Alpine Fault. And as you said, what they found, the main finding of this, was that temperatures were remarkably hot in the Alpine Fault, and the pressures, the water pressures underneath, were also very, very high as well. So the Alpine Fault is basically runs up the Southern Alps, and it supposedly ruptures every 300 or so years, and it gives rise to roughly a sort of a magnitude 8 earthquake. The last time it ruptured was 1717. So this is 300 years.
coming up to its next time.
Indeed. And so it's very, very unusual. The high temperatures and the pressures you normally see in areas that have got volcanism. So you'd expect that possibly more in the North Island than the South Island. South Island doesn't have any volcanoes. There's no volcanoes on the Alpine Fault. And so therefore that's quite surprising.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And so they are potentially, they're talking about using this as a potential geothermal power source,
which
is kind of interesting. They say that, you know, the temperatures and the pressures would lend themselves very, very easily to having a geothermal power station there, which will raise the ire of some, but it sounds like sounds like a good idea, I reckon. You know, it's good renewable clean energy. So, and the other thing about this is that normally, this is the first time it's been done on a fault that has yet to rupture or hasn't ruptured for a long time. Generally, when people drill in faults, they're drilling them after an earthquake has happened. And this time they're drilling it before an earthquake's happened. So that's what makes the novelty of this.
Right. So, and does that sort of have some significance for the international research community as well?
Yeah. Well, again, it's all adding to knowledge. And, you know, one day in the near future or the distant future, we'll be able to predict earthquakes. And this all goes to that. So this is, you know, a contribution to the font of knowledge about geological structures and potential earthquakes. Yeah.
So helping, so more knowledge to help model.
Yes. Yeah.
Future hazards.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, and as I said, it's a Nature paper, which is, you know, that's a real wonderful thing for New Zealand science. So
the one of the heavyweight journals.
It's the heavyweight journal. Everyone wants to get published in Nature. So yeah.
And lastly today, we're looking at a new study that suggests atheists are more intelligent because they can override religious instinct. I feel like this is a pretty big call when you sent me this story, Alan. Not going to lie.
Well, so it actually surprised me too. So apparently the fact, and it is a fact, that there is a negative correlation between religiosity and intelligence was first studied in, or first proposed anyway, in 1924, which surprised me. And ever since then, there's been about 60-odd studies replicating these results. And I had no idea this existed. And apparently, the more fundamentalist you are, the lower your intelligence is, apparently.
But like on average, though, you know, this is a correlation thing. Let's be clear.
It's just a trend. It's a correlation. It doesn't say anything about individual particular people, but there is this particular negative correlation. And so these researchers in England and in the Netherlands, they did this meta-analysis of all of these studies and then came up with the idea to explain the observed results that religion is an instinct. So, you know, sort of this inbred thing that we are supposedly born with, and that intelligent people are able to override their instincts. And particularly in times of stress and stuff like that, where you just, you know, operate by instinct, people who have higher intelligence can sort of step back, override their instincts, and then pick the sensible thing to do. And so this is their explanation, I guess, of these data. Now, this is psychology, and you know, what I don't get about psychology, there's been 63 studies of this correlation. Why the need for 63 studies? You know, if you do it once or twice or something like that, you've pretty much nailed it, haven't you?
Yeah.
Jeez, where do they get the funding to do 63 different studies on the same bloody thing? If we did that in chemistry, we'd be laughed out of court. But, you know, psychologists are different. And again, you know, this is just a proposal. It's not God's revealed truth or anything like that, but this is their explanation of these particular data. So they're saying that religion is an instinct. It's something that we're born with, which leads to all sorts of questions its own right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm really curious what made them choose to treat religion as an instinct.
Good question. Very, very, very good question. But
it's like, isn't religion like a worldview just as, you know, atheism as? So why does, I don't know.
And now you're getting into the philosophy of things. And then, their point was that if it is an instinct and you know, since the dawn of sort of modern, quote unquote, man, sort of 11,000 years ago, you know, our way of life has changed. We've gone from being hunter-gatherers to, you know, sit on the couch and look at TV is sort
of
thing.
Whatever we are.
Yeah. And so what was a good instinct back in those days might not necessarily be good for us these days. And so that was sort of their point, that the ability to override that instinct is a trait of intelligence or a mark of intelligence or whatever. And they made an interesting point that in 1998 they did a survey and they found that 3.3% of members of the Royal Society believed in God. And I've got to say, I'm very surprised it was that low. I do have a few scientist friends who are religious, and I can't quite get around that fact, but, you know, to each their own, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, isn't it something that you could perhaps compartmentalise as well, that, you know, your faith shouldn't really intrude on trying to find robust data from research? I don't know.
No, it shouldn't. Oh, you're absolutely right. But I just find it very difficult to reconcile the two, because they do kind of tend to be, to me, anyway, mutually exclusive.
Right.
But, you know, saying that, you're going to get hundreds of calls after this.
Yeah.
as you do every week.
I know what you mean, in the way that as a researcher you have to be open to the uncertain and not have any sorts of things.
Barriers that are in the way.
So perhaps having a faith, you maybe might have more ideas of certainty than somebody who doesn't.
I think that's a fair point. Absolutely.
Maybe that's the sort of conclusion that we can come to, with hopefully not offending anybody. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us again, Alan.
We'll not a see problem,
you. Great to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
We'll see you again next week.
Cool, will do.
That was Dear Science.
Your Honour, all I'm guilty of is hunger.
Yet you're at Love Bucket, drinking handcrafted cocktails on tap.
I just couldn't fight my urges, Your Honour.
Then I sentence you to a collaborative concoction of comfort foods, bursting with Asian flavours and a pinch of playfulness.
What?
Thursday to Saturday evenings this month, Judge Bao hijacks the Love Bucket kitchen for a three-week residency. Sentence your taste buds to delicious modern Chinese with expert drink matching by the amazing Love Bucket team. The Judge Bao pop-up kitchen at Love Bucket, only at 309 K Road.
You love music, right?
Yes.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95 BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 5395 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6pm today. Then join Pearl from 7pm as she starts counting them down. The 95 BFM Top 10 with your host, Pearl. Tonight from 7 o'clock and always online at 95bfm.com.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Yes, you're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM, our next piece for today. Now, we all know that anti-establishment sentiment has been an increasingly more relevant and contentious topic around the world, and especially it's something to talk about considering we're going into an election this year. So my producer, Will Parsonson, spoke to Grant Duncan, a professor in politics and public policy, to ask him about the changing landscape of international democracies.
Yes, at the moment it's looking all over the place because in some countries, particularly, say, Holland and France, there's been quite a dramatic fragmentation and almost a disappearance of the traditional centre-left, centre-right duopoly parties, you know, a kind of centre-right conservative party and a centre-left Labour or social democratic party basically ruling the political scene in a sort of two-horse race. So in those two countries, that's pretty much been ended, and whereas in the UK and in Germany at the moment, the opinion polls, if they're to be believed, are showing that those two, you know, centre-right, centre-left parties are having a bit of a resurgence. And in the UK, of course, that's getting interesting because they have an election quite soon. Now, if a similar kind of fragmentation, similar to, say, Holland, were to happen in New Zealand, then the equivalent scenario would be a situation where, say, it could get as dramatic as, say, Labour and National combined, you know, barely reaching, say, 50% of the party vote. In the last election, those two parties combined got 72%. But if we were to follow the lead of some of those European countries, that could dramatically decline in the future. I'm not saying that'll happen this coming election, but further down the track, that's the kind of landscape we could see.
Would you say that public opinion is influencing the gap to grow between right wing and left wing, or are we moving more central in terms of international politics and international democracy?
Well, the interesting thing about the present national-led government, of course, has been its consistent shuffling towards the left, really. And so that's making it a little bit difficult for the Labour Party to manoeuvre in terms of policy and its sort of ideological position. But yeah, so what's happening is that the four major parties in New Zealand at the moment, Labour, National, New Zealand First and Greens, are all really competing for the centre. There's not really much representation on either the radical left or radical right wings at all. And so it's a crowded centre in New Zealand at the moment. But it does possibly leave a considerable section of New Zealanders feeling as if no political party in Parliament at the moment genuinely represents their values and interests.
Going off that, you're saying that Labour and National are competing with each other for maybe a more central view on things and looking to represent New Zealanders. Would you say that the influence of other countries, dramatic changes within political parties and the potential move to like strong left and strong right, is that affecting New Zealanders' opinions on our own government?
Yeah, that's the big question, isn't it? Whether the rise of populist movements and voter revenge, so to speak, in the Brexit referendum and the election of Trump and the overseas are going to have a similar effect on New Zealand. And that was certainly the question that was entertaining my mind since those events last year. The sense I'm getting at the moment, this is just my gut feeling at the moment, is that kind of populist anti-establishment sentiment isn't taking off in a major way in New Zealand at the moment. But, you know, events could prove me wrong, of course, and certainly the politician most able, most well-positioned to take advantage of any kind of populist revolt, of course, is Winston Peters. And, you know, he's doing his usual thing, but I don't really see, in terms of opinion polling, him enjoying any kind of boost at the moment just because of, you know, some kind of long-distance effect of Trump and Brexit are happening in New Zealand. So that doesn't really seem to be happening here at the moment.
That's interesting because we talked to Winston Peters a few months ago and he seemed to think the anti-establishment wave sweeping the globe began with him here in New Zealand first with the Northland by-election. What could you make of this?
Well, that's just, you know, his staring do kind of talk, isn't it? And part of the Winston Peters that we know and love. So, I mean, he's also claiming that the opinion polls, which put him on about 9 or 10%, are way underestimating his real support in the electorate at the moment. But, of course, he won't show us the opinion polls that he's using. And ultimately, we have to wait until the election in 23 September to see how well he really does. But, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, and Nigel Farage from the UK Independence Party, or the former leader of that party, was boasting about he being the initiator of this so-called global revolution that he was talking about. But UKIP in the UK is really tanking in the opinion polls there now. And similarly in Germany, the alternative, you know, Germany party, which is the strong anti-immigration, anti-refugee party over there, they're also tanking in the opinion polls there too. So I think that this so-called global revolution actually is looking like a little bit of a scissor at the moment. And I think Winston Peters would probably be unwise to talk it up too much because he may just end up looking a little bit disappointed on election day. So, yeah, although obviously there was a sort of sense that there was this kind of global tide of anti-establishment populist sentiment, I'm just not convinced at the moment that it's really sort of turning into a great tsunami that's going to sweep over New Zealand as well.
So would you say that you wouldn't expect many changes to come of this perceived anti-establishment sentiment? Would you say that things might stay as they are? Or,
well, pretty much. I mean, if, you know, looking ahead to the next election, there's no great signs of a shift to, you know, a change of government to a Labour-led government. I'm not saying it can't happen. It can happen, particularly, you know, if you were to get a Labour New Zealand First coalition and the Greens were willing to support that arrangement. It's a rather awkward kind of three-party arrangement, but it could happen. That sort of thing has been done before. But the more likely outcome is a National New Zealand First coalition. A lot depends, of course, on how well National actually does and how well its existing support parties do. The Māori Party, for instance, ACT and United Future. So there's a lot of moving parts there, to be honest. It's quite difficult to pick which way it would go. But I guess if you were a betting person, you'd probably say that we would have a National-led government after the next election, just looking at the landscape at the moment. But I don't like to, you know, be too confident making those predictions. But, yeah, sorry, I missed a bit of your question there. Can you run it by me again?
Given these perceptions of anti-establishment, you know, the perceptions that people are having these anti-establishment ideas, what could that mean for New Zealand in the future?
Well, we have had such a sort of voter revolt, and I'm thinking back to 1993 when two interesting things happened. One, we had a vote for the MMP electoral system, and that referendum really can be seen as an anti-establishment kind of voter revolt, I think. And we also, of course, saw the, you know, New Zealand First appear in Parliament with two seats, and the Alliance won two seats as well. So two minor parties got into Parliament, despite the fact that we still had the old SPP system at that election. And they were very much, you know, anti-globalisation, anti-neoliberal type parties. So you could argue that 1993 was our anti-establishment moment in New Zealand, and yes, indeed, we could, you know, one day face another such voter revolt. At the moment, I'm not seeing a lot of evidence that that's actually going to happen in New Zealand. And I mean, I can always be proven wrong, can't I? Because you never know what's going to happen between now and September. But you know, I don't really sense that there's a great deal of willingness on the part of New Zealanders to really shake up the system. Having said that, of course, you know, there is a lot of cynicism and distrust out there amongst Kiwis. You just have to go online and read, you know, comments, columns to see, you know, what people have to say about parties on both sides of the House. So there's certainly a lot of that kind of anger and distrust around, but I'm not sure whether it's going to translate into a major political or more electoral upset.
That was The Wire.
Yes, you did just hear Bridge whisper, "More freedom, less government" on air. Reading out from that, of course, we have to attribute that to our dear listener, Cheers Peter. Thank you for your text. Actually, thank you to all of you who texted in. We got some really great feedback. Somebody said it would be interesting to see just how much per student the government is spending now compared to when they first got into power. So that's in reference to the interview I did with Tracy Martin from New Zealand First, who was talking about the budget announced last week. Yes, listener, I do agree. It'll be interesting to look at that. Maybe that could be some fodder for a wire in the future. But that is the end of our show today. Thank you to everybody who spoke with us. That is Greg Harford, Maxine Gay, Tracy Martin, Alan Blackman, and also Grant Duncan at the end there. Unfortunately, we've run out of time to play our last interview with Thomas Owen, who has travelled over to the Yukon in Canada and is doing some research there, which sounds like a really interesting topic, but I want to play that in full for you all next week, so tune in then. But yes, thank you to my two producers, Adam and Will, and up next is the 1-4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.